Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 2:30 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is October 15th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. There's a couple of things that have been going through my mind today, but one is that there's no easy way to talk about it. It's simply that bureaucrats, when they get the bit between their teeth, they just will not let go of an idea. So the conventional media have been rallying around the idea that this massive surge in energy, particularly in natural gas prices in Europe, the shutting down of fertilizer companies and the threat that they may not open again, and then the massive supply difficulties in sourcing carbon dioxide. And I'm still smiling at the irony of that. And all of that is being met with this attempt by Europe to create a taxonomy of green policies. What qualifies as a green policy? What doesn't? France animating for more weighting or giving greener weighting to nuclear power. And Germany, and particularly the German Green Party, being completely opposed to giving uranium a place. And then this is almost like splitting the baby, which is they're going to create carbon prices that are considerably higher than where they are today. But the common sense approach would be simply to, if one really did want to reduce carbon in the atmosphere, then just simply substitute natural gas for coal. Of course, that would require a great deal more natural gas production. There's absolutely no appetite for that, because it is not nearly ambitious enough from the perspective of some of the carbon fanatics. So this is playing into the hands of OPEC, and the Saudi Arabian index is breaking out of a 15-year base formation, and the merger between Saudi Aramco and SABIC back, it was like 3 years ago, is looking increasingly inspired, because Saudi Arabia back then realized that there was going to be a significant effort underway to try and stop using the product that they rely on for most of their income, so that they would have to move up the value chain and start supplying additional products. So basic raw ingredients like fertilizers are obviously one of those, and fertilizer prices have been surging. So the North American fertilizer price is breaking out to new all-time highs, and this is higher than it was at the peak back in 2007. But what I find especially interesting is that the acceleration that we've had this year is quicker than the one that we had in 2007 and 2008. Now, I'm not sure that we're going to get a chart from Bloomberg for Potash Corpus Saskatchewan. And I do believe I still have that in our chart library. But the reality is that when we think about the recovery that we're starting to see in the fertilizer complex, it's nothing compared to the size of the move that we had in some of those companies back in the period immediately before the credit crisis. So we can look at Potash Corpus Saskatchewan, where the price went from under $4 in 2004 to 80 at the peak in 2008. So that was an extraordinary move. And there was a real panic at the time that we were going to run out of food. And now we're looking at an environment where the fertilizer price has been accelerated at a pace even quicker than what we saw in 2006, and yet some of these fertilizer companies are really only just breaking out of their base formations. So Mosaic might be way off the low from back in 2020, but it's really only breaking its sequence of lower rally highs now, and we do need to pull in more back history to get a real idea of just how high prices were back in 2008. And of course, Nutrien has been the merger now between Potash Corporate Saskatchewan and Agrium. So we've had some significant consolidation in the sector. But the other point, of course, is that it's a highly concentrated sector. And one of the things that I was thinking about today is that when we think about how to invest in these sectors, well, there used to be an ETF for fertilizers, and it was delisted earlier this year because there was just nobody interested in buying. So they stopped updating this price back in August of this year. And that is also indicative of fewer people being interested. It takes a while for ETFs to start to come back into the market, especially after one has proven to be a failure. So because the ETF had been going down then and losing assets, well, then they just don't have an incentive to continue to hold on to it. And the business model of ETF providers is simple enough. They throw as many ideas at the wall as possible. Those that attract assets get continue, and those that don't fail. Now, if there's background noise, I do apologize. It's because my neighbors are cutting a tree down in front of me, and they're not even halfway done yet, so I don't know how long it's going to take them. But when we think about what that means for asset classes, what it really tells us is that it's under-owned, because you don't have ETFs that are investing in these companies. So they may be parts of wider indices, or they may be part of, say, the resources sector overall, but these companies are not sufficiently large to occupy large weightings in those sectors, and then there isn't dedicated ETFs to invest in them. So therefore, they're by definition underowned when the vast majority of assets in the world today are held within ETFs, and the ETF industry continues to erode the conventional just managed portfolio. And what that also suggests is that is the primary reason why we have not seen the same kind of stock performance, despite the fact that the raw fertilizer price has already broken upwards to new all-time highs. Now, the other big sector that is looking increasingly important is the Indian infrastructure. And in that presentation I made for the IFTA conference last week, I put in a chart of India's credit cycle. So India's credit cycle went through a very painful process of consolidation. And when we think about what that means, well, there were a significant number of housing finance companies went bust. And that resulted in the credit in the market contracting, going into negative territory overall. And that started in 2012, and it's pretty much continued until about 2018-19. And now it's starting to turn back upwards. So considering that this goes all the way back to 96, and we can see the ebb and flow of credit in the market, well, it's supportive of the view that institutional investors in India have had for a while, that there is a credit cycle in India, just like there's a credit cycle everywhere else, and that we are now turning the corner for Indian infrastructure. And then you have Modi coming out this week and talking about the dire need to remove silos from inside the government bureaucracy, which is a really worthy ambition. And if he is successful in streamlining India's bureaucracy and knocking down fiefdoms within the agricultural and then the infrastructure bureaucracies and fiefdoms, well, it would be an incredible step forward for Indian governance overall. So then, if we're thinking about India and infrastructure development, well, there was an India Infrastructure Fund, and it doesn't exist anymore. So this index, they stopped updating it in 2019. And again, that's another example that when people now look for assets and for sectors that they can invest in, well, the first port of call is an ETF. And India is really doing spectacularly well on the upside, and the Nifty index continues to push on to new high ground. And the rupee, it's certainly not the strongest currency in the world, and it was at a new reaction low in here this week, but it's not breaking down either. And the big and then India is expected to be one of the highest growth markets in the world this year and next year, approaching growth rates of around 8%. So then, of course, the big question is whether they're going to be able to control inflation. But the bigger point, of course, is that if India is now moving into a new credit cycle, it means that banks will lend more, borrowers will borrow more, they'll invest in infrastructure, they'll invest in construction. That will have a multiplier effect in terms of economic potential. It will allow the massive young population to achieve at least partially their productive potential, and it will transform the economy over the course of the next decade. And that's generally how the credit cycle works. Obviously, it will climax in exaggerated prices for property, and potentially India being very ambitious and going off and trying to build the tallest skyscraper in the world. Those are the kinds of things you would see at the climax of a credit cycle. But since we're only at the beginning of it now, well, then it suggests that demand for credit is going to significantly increase, as well as supply, and banks will have a multiplier effect. So banks are also breaking on the upside in here. And we can think then about the companies that were the victims during the deleveraging process. So Yes Bank collapsed from 400 to 13, and so far it has not yet taken part in the releveraging process. D1 Housing and Finance basically no longer exists. It's been taken over. So now you have Piramal Enterprises, and of course they're involved in commercial finance, and they were able to buy up D1's assets at attractive prices, and their own share price is then pushing on to new high ground. And then, of course, we have the significant potential that we're going to have infrastructure development, not just on a piecemeal scale, but on an epic scale in India. So Larsen and Toubro is breaking on the upside. The cement companies are also doing well. When we think about the wider market, then the BSE 500 has been going up practically in an unabated fashion for most of the last 18 months, so it's a significant acceleration of the previous uptrend. But I think it's particularly important to view these kinds of moves on a log scale chart, because when we think about India, it's a secular bull market phenomenon, and there have been significant periods When the price went up for a very prolonged period, 2000 to 2008 was a good example of that. Then it went sideways for about 7 years and then went up in a meaningful manner again, but not nearly in as an impressive manner, and not least because the credit cycle peaked in about 2014, and then that really started to delay the ability of the stock market to continue to advance. So now that we're in a new credit cycle, it doesn't mean that we're not going to have occasional issues. India is an emerging market, and obviously there are going to be hiccups along the road, and there will be occasional bouts of volatility. But at the same time, this is a long-term growth market. And we've definitely seen over the course of the last decade that the number of ways to invest in India has contracted. So there are still plenty of equity-focused markets. And that offers some way of entering the market from an international perspective, and there are still capital controls, and it's difficult to establish big positions by foreign investors in the market. But the number on and the complexity of products to offer access to India is going to increase as awareness of this credit cycle continues. And the one thing that India has been really lacking is infrastructure. So anything that improves that situation will have a significant multiplier effect right across the economy. And that this is doubly important because the West simply can't afford for India to fail. The big bet is that India will become the regional counterweight to China. So, India is going to find itself in a very benign environment where it's going to find assistance being provided in any number of ways that were perhaps not open to it in the past, and that is also likely to be extraordinarily beneficial. So, then we can think about, well, what are the other sectors that no longer have ETFs? Well, we still have ETFs for uranium, but a large number of those uranium companies went bust. And some of them, they didn't go bust, they just renamed themselves rare earth metal companies. So the GlobalX ETF is, well, it was at a new recovery high today, this week, then pulled back a little over the last couple of days. But it looks like a recovery scenario overall, and it has clearly broken out of the base formation. And then, of course, it's worth reminding ourselves that the peak for uranium was in 2005. So the fact that this ETF came to life in 2010 and then collapsed, well, it doesn't even come close to really illustrating just how high prices were back in 2005. Cameco might be a better way of looking at that, but even then, it didn't accelerate in the same way as some of those very small companies did in 2005. In fact, we do have still have the old price, and this was also is one of the rather difficult things that we are, I think, challenges that we encounter with monitoring the uranium price, because they change the ticker and they change the price series really quite regularly. I've had to change it at least 10 times in the last decade. So the original price, we could see that it went from 20 to 140 in the space of 2 years. So that was a really incredible advance. I apologize. I thought it was 2005. The peak was in 2007. Now, when we think about that, well, we've had a lot of ebb and flow in terms of arguments about whether uranium was in a new bull market or not, and there have been a lot of false dawns. And I did also post a rather interesting chart this week of German expectations for what the energy mix would be in the middle of this century, but it was from the 1960s. And they thought that it would be all nuclear power by then, and of course, that has not happened. What it also helps to highlight is that these long-term prognostications about what the energy mix is going to be in the future, they generally tend to be wrong and are much more reflective of what the prevailing environment is at the time. And then also, they tend to go, or at least what they do is they extend a linear progression. So what that really tells us is that we need to take into account what's going on in real time, and then also to try and figure out, well, what will the response to those kinds of events be? So when we think about oil prices, because crude oil has been breaking on the upside and it is establishing itself above the $80 area. And it's doing that because there's less investment coming in to bring more supply to market. There's a lot of political will to try and increase the cost of energy in order to force substitution. So this is in many respects politically motivated, and that's hard to argue with, because it's not like we don't know where the oil is. We do. We know exactly where the oil is. There's plenty of oil in Canada, there's plenty of oil in Venezuela, and there's plenty of oil offshore. But there's no willingness to go off and to develop those resources because there's so much opposition. And then, of course, we can think about the significant investments that the automotive sector have engaged in to provide electric vehicles. So then the oil companies are looking at those kinds of investments and thinking, well, they don't have the kind of security of demand growth that they had once, and why would they invest hundreds of billions of dollars in developing new sources of oil and gas when the rest of the world is doing their utmost to try and use less of it? So that continues to put upward pressure on the price. And this has also been true of natural gas, and of course, that's feeding through into the fertilizer price as well. And of course, all of these commodity-related price increases, well, they're contributing to inflationary pressures. So, when we think about the 10-year TIPS, it's still at around a negative 1%. And there's not a real, or at least there's no real evidence that the TIPS yield is going to suddenly move back into positive territory. Now, I think that there are a couple of different things here. The first is that investors want inflation protection. And if you're a bond investor, well, then the range of different things that you can buy to protect yourself against inflation is comparatively small. So you either go really, really short duration or you buy TIPS. And then, of course, we also know that the Federal Reserve is buying TIPS, and they've bought a sufficiently large number of them that they've compressed the yield as well. So that's ensuring that we have negative real interest rates. Then we can also think about the 5-year, 5-year in 5 years break-even rate. So this is the expected break-even rate for it's the expected 5-year yield in 5 years' time. And it's at about 2.36%, which isn't particularly ambitious. But it's the highest closing value we've seen in at least the last 6 years. And it looks like an uptrend. It looks like it's going to go higher from here. Of course, the 5-year yield is about 100 basis points below where we are right now. So this is just another way of looking at that negative real interest rate environment that we have from 10-year tips. But what it is also suggesting, because of the trend, it's that investors are willing to price in that we're going to have more inflation. And of course, this is also coming down to the very essence of the argument, because it looks increasingly likely that we are in a new inflationary environment, but perhaps not for the same reasons that many people think, because the surges we've had in some of the commodities, like oil and natural gas, are politically motivated. And the fact that carbon prices have not pulled back more is supportive of the view that the political class don't particularly want to have weaker carbon prices. So we had a downward move in here today, and it countermanded the upward dynamic we had yesterday. And I do think it's more likely than not that we're going to come back down to the trend mean, which could potentially take us back towards the 50 area. But beyond that seems to be a rather ambitious forecast, because European politicians want higher carbon prices. So that's going to contribute to higher energy prices overall, because they're just going to make sure that there are higher energy prices to encourage substitution. And that's going to contribute to inflation one way or the other. So that's one source of inflation. But considering the fact that most central banks don't look at energy prices in their calculation of inflation, well, then in many respects, it's irrelevant, even though it's going to feed through into other parts of the economy. Now, we also have this phenomenon where there are lots of people sitting outside of the labor market and they're not coming back in. And it might be because they've built up savings, so they're going to wait until those savings have been eroded before they come back into the economy and start looking for jobs. Or they may have simply had a schooling in during the or at least they've learned lessons from the pandemic that they really are worth more than they were being paid, because obviously the government thinks they were worth more because they were giving them more in unemployment benefits than they were getting from working in the first place. So when you basically tell people that they should be asking for more money, well, then the first thing they're going to do is go back out and ask for more money. So we've seen that the Atlanta Fed wage growth tracker broke higher this week. So it was updated for the end of the third quarter. It's up to 4.2%, and this completes a 6-year range. So wages are definitely breaking on the upside. Now, the iron law of wages, according to David Ricardo, hundreds of years ago, it was simple enough that whatever the prevailing basic rate of pay is will approximate what the subsistence level of income required to survive in the economy is. Well, in an environment where we have rather generous social benefits, then it's about supply and demand. We know what the lower bound is, and unfortunately, the cost of survival, not prospering, but simply survival, is increasing all the time. And the cost of just basic goods and services continues to increase, and energy plays a very significant role in that. And food prices are going to start rising because of the rising cost of fertilizers. It's going to impede the ability of farmers to fertilize and therefore increase their yields. So agricultural prices remain on an uptrend overall. And then we have the additional point that central banks, they began thinking that the inflation would be transitory and they didn't want to do anything to derail it. But and everyone still seems to wonder about what central banks are going to do. But we've had a very different environment from government. So it's on the fiscal front, which is, I think, the very big change in this regard. After the very significant advance in commodity prices following the credit crisis, where we had this profound change in the continuous commodity index, where it bottomed in late 2008, and by the time we got around to the beginning of 2011, we were at significant new highs. So we had a 2.5 year inflation scare, and then China's stimulus started to ebb. The Tea Party started to demand that there was going to be some kind of limit on spending, and then the sovereign wealth crisis in Europe resulted in significant fiscal austerity. So what we had on three continents was almost, perhaps not quite simultaneous, but within the space of 18 months, we had three major economies stop spending and start to think about how they were going to normalize. And that killed off the bull market in commodities. Well, right now, what's happening in China is particularly interesting. And but then we can think about Europe, where they had been engaged in fiscal austerity for most of the last decade, and the appetite for trying to enforce budgetary constraints in the aftermath of the pandemic and the ongoing pandemic is just non-existent. So there's no appetite for fiscal austerity in Europe, and that is helping to support the stock market. And the Euro Stoxx index has now completed a decades-long base formation, and it is firming from the region of the trend mean. So it's looking increasingly likely that Europe is back on the front foot. Japan has absolutely no intention of engaging in any kind of fiscal austerity, and they're still one of the more activist in terms of monetary accommodation. So the topics is firming from it, the region of the trend mean as well, and it's also completed an even longer base formation. So this also looks like we're seeing the repercussions of governments that are willing to simply spend. And then we can think about the USA, where both parties, they're basically not willing to help each other to spend money, but as soon as they have a majority, they have big plans to spend money on their own favorite projects. And nobody is in any mood for any kind of fiscal austerity because that is just not going to play well with their respective populations, or demographic people or voters. So we're in an environment here where there's going to be continued support in terms of fiscal spending. There's no appetite for tightening. And this is this sort of jerky supply of money is going to persist. So we'll have some ebb and flow, but we're still in a reasonably benign environment, and this trend continues. I still have those notations on the NASDAQ chart. So this was, in fact, a smaller reaction than either of the last two, and now the price is pushing upwards once more. So it's still holding the region of the 200-day moving average, and as long as that remains the case, well, then we're going to continue to see trending and ranging, and we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Now, we know we have extraordinary valuations, and the USA in particular has got valuations that are well in excess of mostly anywhere else. So we can think about the price to book ratio or the price earnings ratio of the indices, and they're at, back in 2017, price to book was 5, now it's nearly 9. And of course, the argument would be that it's not about book value anymore, it's about intangible assets. And there's a good argument for that because a lot of the investments that are going into software and into the cloud and into technology, they are intangible. But then attaching a value to them and amortizing that value, because obviously it's a fast-moving sector, and software is something that needs to be renewed continually. And there is obviously a set, I guess, time value on how long those pieces of software are going to be valuable. I think these are some of the important kinds of considerations to think about when we think about intangible values. But we're still in a benign environment. We're still in an environment where central banks are talking about withdrawing liquidity, and we've seen a number of the commodity producers beginning to raise rates. And we're in more of an inflationary environment because governments have no tolerance for fiscal consolidation. One thing that I think is interesting is that a lot of people look at the inflation that we have now and they say this is nothing like the 1970s. And that's right, because the late 1970s was the peak of the inflationary cycle. So it's not really correct to compare the inflation that we have today to the late 1970s, because this is the beginning of a new inflationary cycle. So it would be much more correct to think about what's happening today in terms of the late 1960s. And if that's correct, well, then gold remains something that has got significant upside potential. Now, it was it failed to push up and through the $1,800 area today. So we still have a preponderance of downward dynamics. This downward dynamic today is not as large as some of the other ones we've seen over the last year, but the sequence of lower rally highs remains intact. Now, the one thing that people who've been successfully shorting gold have had in their favor is that every time it's pulled back, it's done so in a dynamic manner. So even with the peak from early September, it pulled back by about $100. And the real evidence that we're coming out the other end of a corrective phase would be that the downdrafts start moderating and the updrafts start becoming more intense. So we're definitely getting a narrowing of trading. And as long as that low around $1,725 holds, well, then this triangular pattern is still in play. And I do think that there is more likely than not that gold is going to break on the upside. And we're really only at the dawn of a new inflationary cycle, which would suggest that emerging markets are likely to do better because they have more experience at dealing with inflation overall, so they know how to deal with it, and they also have the higher growth rate to compensate from what's going on. So the emerging markets ex China ETF also bounced from the region of its 200-day moving average today. I remain very much of the view that China is a trader's market. And it's at the lower side of the range right now. So, from a trader's perspective, it's becoming more interesting. I think as we look at the Hang Seng and the fact that it really hasn't gone anywhere for at least the last 13 years, well, There is obviously the scope that we're towards the lower side of the range, so we might go back up towards the upper side of the range. And the H-share index has done worse, and it's also right at the lower side of its range. So there's certainly potential for additional upside. But it's not going to be from the property developers. It's going to be the politically favored sectors. So Geely Automotive is bouncing from the region of the trend mean. BYD has also been really quite firm, and it's also bouncing this time, but much closer to its all-time highs. So coming up on a closing value that's a new all-time high. There's obviously potential here that China's sectors that will contribute to its longer-term objectives of global hegemony and energy independence will do well because they have the blessing of heaven, which basically equates to the imprimatur from the central government. So there's certainly going to be trading opportunities in China. What I find also interesting is that China's credit cycle has not yet bottomed, but it is likely to bottom. And that's also a reason why a number of the more speculative sectors are doing well, because we're in an environment where there is a big question hanging over the property developers market. And we've had the bankruptcy of China Evergrande and the collapse of Fantasia, and a number of the other highly levered companies are also coming under duress. But the Hang Seng Properties Index is rebounding, and it's worth reminding ourselves that in terms of the weighting of the index, well, those highly levered companies don't occupy quite the same weighting. And then Country Garden Services remains well bid. Country Garden Holdings has been one of the bigger decliners. So there's certainly potential that there are additional surprises coming through in the property market. And it's a philosophical argument whether the Chinese approach, which is to limit upside and give investors exposure to their assets going to zero, or the Western way, which is to give unlimited upside and to backstop the worst potential for things to go to zero. Neither of them is particularly capitalistic. And the West has had more crises because they're willing to allow prices to go way higher than would normally happen, and then they've schooled investors to anticipate that there would be a central bank put in the market. Well, China has allowed a phenomenal bubble to evolve in the property sector. They're trying to curtail it, and the problem is that they think that they don't have to support the market, and they're probably going to have to find out the hard way that they will have to do that. Because it's all well and good to have this academic argument and to be rather steadfast in thinking that moral hazard is a terrible thing and it shouldn't be accepted in a market-driven economy. And China says they want to deliver on a market-driven economy. But their interpretation of that is that you must allow bankruptcies. Whereas the Western way of thinking is that a market-driven economy leaves the potential for unlimited upside and for risky investments to reach full fruition and to deliver outsized benefits to the wider economy. And then when things go wrong, well, then it's the central bank's duty to come in and ensure that the worst contractions are avoided. So China is going to have this existential question presented to it by the difficulties that are being experienced by the property market, because these things tend to snowball. And when you get less demand for property, and then you start to see that property developers have difficulty selling properties, or much less completing the whatever properties they've already committed to, and they're relying on pre-sales to fund general operations, well, then that can have a really deleterious effect. And the most benign outcome would be what happened in India, because we had companies like Yes Bank and Dewan Housing Finance go bust, and it curtailed some growth in the economy, but it did not derail growth. So the big question then is the situation in China that much bigger? Because they never allowed defaults in the past. So the problem has got bigger and metastasized over time. Or can they limit it in terms of its exposure in the same way that India did? And by the way India did that was they relied on the state banks or the state-owned banks rather than the private sector banks. And it's likely that China is probably going to try and do the same thing. They're going to rely on their state-owned banking sector, and they're going to force mergers. They're going to ensure that the properties that people bought off the plans will get built, but then they're going to burn the international investors. When we think about what the where the potential lies for emerging markets, well, they should do well in an inflationary environment, and the Chinese renminbi remains extremely steady, so that's helping to support interest in the bond markets and interest in the stock markets. And the US dollar has paused around this 95 area. It was in negative territory again in here today. But this is mostly euro. And Europe doesn't want a strong currency. So there's obviously the potential here that the dollar index is going to remain reasonably firm. Until we in fact see the dollar pulling back in a dynamic manner, then we're not going to see a big swell of new money flowing into emerging markets. But I think that what we're seeing right now is more of a trickle in terms of what the potential for additional flow is. And of course, the other market that's attracting a lot of interest right now is Bitcoin. So ETFs that are investing in Bitcoin futures are about to be permissioned. So the price was up $4,000 in here today, and it isn't quite at a new all-time high, but we are really not all that far away from that level. So it has completely regrouped following the big decline in April. Now the big question is, what happens next? Are we going to see what happened with the introduction of the futures market the last time around? Because when Bitcoin futures were introduced, the price surged ahead of that event, and subsequently everyone shorted the futures because they wanted to hedge their long exposure, and then the price started to come back down. With the introduction of the Bitcoin futures-based ETFs, well, are people going to use those as vehicles to buy, or are they going to short them in an effort to hedge their long exposure? So I suspect that at the moment it's likely they're going to buy, and we're likely to see additional upside here following the significant recovery. We're also starting to see that the Ethereum price has started to firm and is beginning to play catch up with Bitcoin, but it hasn't broken out yet. And until it breaks out, well, then we won't have clear indications or confirmation that the uptrend has been renewed. But The one thing that we know is that there's a great deal of money still sloshing around. It's likely that we're at the peak of the most liquid financial condition environment. We're moving more now into a slow and steady portion of this bull market where there's still accommodation, growth is slowing down. That's likely to delay or slow down the pace of tapering and interest rate hikes, which will allow valuations to continue to rise in a reasonably benign environment overall. And of course, with this continued rise in the commodity prices, it's likely to create demand for commodity exporters. So the Brazilian market continues to bounce here, and the Brazilian real has steadied up somewhat. The Australian dollar has continued to steady, and that's likely to continue to support the resources sector there. The Australian gold miners have pulled back in a really extraordinary fashion, and are beginning to firm once more. And we can definitely think then about the GDX ETF, where we've had emphatic rebounds now from the region of the upper side of the underlying base formation. So this entire range that's been forming for the last year and a half looks like a big first step above the base. If we're in a new inflationary environment, then emerging markets should do better. Commodity producers should do better. And obviously, they trade a lot with one another. And Europe and Japan are only just beginning to play catch up with Wall Street. It's Wall Street has the highest valuations, and those trends are still intact. So investors don't have a great incentive to reorientate their investments away from Wall Street and into other markets. But on a relative strength basis, then commodities in emerging markets, Europe and Japan, are likely to outperform Wall Street, and most particularly the most highly levered portions of Wall Street going forward. And I think that's going to remain the case as long as bond yields continue to push higher. We're at this also interesting juncture because the yield curve spread has been both up and down this week, and it's currently sitting around 1 point or 117 basis points. Generally speaking, when the yield curve is contracting, it's positive for asset prices, and it's positive all the way through until they go negative. And when we get the so I think that's the lesson, is that generally speaking, when the yield curve's contracting, it's positive for asset prices. When the yield curve is expanding, well, generally it's in response to a problem. So then asset prices tend to experience some difficulty. If for any reason the yield curve spread pushes up through the 160 basis point level, it's probably going to be in response to a problem. And I think that's something that we need to be aware of. There is obviously the scope that if inflationary pressures really do pick up, well, then bond investors are going to start feeling some stress, and that will follow through into difficulty for the high-tech sector. So we still have reasonably consistent trends, but the risks are mounting for the most highly valued portion of the market, and we're getting relative strength coming through in other portions of the global markets. So they would, I think, continue to represent lower risk, potentially better reward than the highly valued portion of the US market. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.